Accession number 10308, reel 3.
Mr. Marchant, reel 3.
Often on working parties, in the earlier days in particular, I think the Japanese did try to split the Australians and the English. They would, for example, give the Australians lighter jobs or better jobs than the English had. They would chase up the English rather more than the Australians, and so on and so forth. But I don't think the Australians fell for it, but they took advantage of it naturally. And I think that happened a lot. They tried to break up the different races. And in particular, I don't think they liked the Eurasians, who turned out to be faithful to the British and joined the Singapore State's volunteer forces and were taken prisoner of war, of course. But there were some extremely nice chaps among those. Extremely.
In what sense?
Well, I can remember one or two absolute gentlemen, and I did, in fact, when I went to Singapore and that part of the world, I asked the Straits Times to put an advert in the paper mentioning certain people's names. I can remember an illegitimate son of the governor of Singapore called Sonny Farah. A thorough gentleman. Chocolate coloured and all the rest of it, but I mean, an absolute gentleman. And so pro-British, unbelievable. I can remember Montero, quite a few of the names. And they're all absolutely first class. And they must have been, otherwise they wouldn't have ended up as prisoners. They could have faded into the civilian population. They didn't want to go in the population. They wanted to stay with the British. Quite fantastic, really, when you think of what it is nowadays. So, however, after finishing on the aerodrome, or just about as it finished, it was quite a long time. I've got August 44, that the war took a turn for the worse for the Japs. And they then started to use prisoners of war in Singapore on war projects, which wasn't really right. They sent myself and a lot more engineers and other people to a camp at Kranji, which is now the official War Graves Commission Cemetery. It's been cleared and it's made the cemetery, and I've visited it since. And the camp was very poor there, and the food was even poorer. It was getting short, was food, because of the successful action by the navies, of course, keeping goods out of Singapore and Malaya. They, in fact, put us on digging tunnels to put ammunition under the ground. And I'd been in the timber trade all my life. Not a long life, but been in the timber trade. And I knew something about timber. And we used to have to collect the timber from the side of the road in the form of long tree trunks, about 6-7 inches diameter, which were used as uprights for the tunnels and head cross pieces for the tunnels. And we had to dig the tunnels and put these up. And we used to always pick the light timbers that were rotten or we felt were not very strong and always put them at the top. So I rather suspect that those tunnels wouldn't last very long. It was very hard work, though, because all you had was a loincloth and no ventilation. It was very hot. And, of course, again, the food was getting worse because it was getting near the times when they were having jobs to get convoys of food in from anywhere else. So it was very difficult indeed. Talking of food, I've got a note of a chicken incident. We were building these tunnels, or digging these tunnels, in hill country in Singapore to put stores in. And near where we were for our lunch one particular day, we knocked off our bowl of rice and so on, was a little native kampong with a few scraggy chickens running about. And I said to my friend, really, you know, I said, we ought to have some of those. I said, the trouble is there's a guard there, et cetera, et cetera. And we thought he was dozing. Anyhow, so we decided to chase these chickens, and they made a hell of a noise. And we got a couple of chickens, and we screwed the net quickly. But the noise had woken the guard up. So he came over, and we thought, oh, hell, we thought we're in for trouble here, a really good bashing. And he looked, and he laughed. And he took one chicken and left us the other one. That, again, is almost unbelievable. So we got away with that very well, actually. He took one, and we kept one. So every Jap wasn't bad all the time, but the majority were, I'm afraid. Hey. Oh, yes. Now, I had an attack of malaria in that camp, and they were very short of working staff. And before I was fully recovered, they came in. They wanted one man. And so I happened to be one that was able to stand up, but not very brilliant. And I went with this Jap, and I went into a lorry. And he took me down to the docks, and natives loaded. I just sat in the lorry. Natives loaded it up with long timber poles. They were for these tunnels, right? And they were all put into a big area near the causeway, big dispersal area near the causeway. It's still there, because I've been and looked. And every morning he picked me up, we got the logs, went there, and while the natives were unloading them, for about a fortnight or more, each morning he unscrewed the spare wheel and I wheeled it for him. And the garage was still there. I saw it about 2 or 3 years ago in Johor. I had to wheel it to this garage, and he flogged it on the black market, came back without it. And while he was upstairs doing his deal, a little Chinese used to give me a bit of food and give me the news. It was fascinating. I did nothing for a fortnight but wheel that tyre up the black market. And every day he must have had a pal in the army store somewhere who was flogging these wheels, and this guard was buying them.
Can you remember what kind of news the Chinese gave you?
Yes, yes, I can. He said it's known now that the English are fighting successfully in Burma. That sort of thing. It's general news rather than, you know, and the Australians, I can remember him saying, have held them in New Guinea. So that in fact, all the bull we heard about Australia was obviously totally wrong. We never did believe it anyhow. So all those sort of things. So they must have had their wirelesses listening to Delhi. And I understand if they were caught, of course, it was serious trouble. I can remember on one of the trips downtown, yes, a shocking sight, over one of the big girders of the bridge that we went along, I can't remember the address, but it was towards the docks area, there were about 8 or 9 native heads stuck. And apparently, the night before, some Jap guards had been killed. The civilians had disappeared and had found the bodies, apparently. So they just took 8 natives out, or however many, it might have been 7 or 6, and chopped the heads off and put them on the top of the bridge. They were very hard on the civilians, were the Japs. Almost as hard as they were, as I think.
Were these Chinese or Malays?
Chinese. Nearly always the Chinese that were anti-Jap, I would think. I didn't think an awful lot of the Malay.
No. Can you remember what kind of thing happened to you after your tyre wheeling incident?
Yes, I went back working on these mine shafts, if you like to call them, up in the hillsides. And it was in that period, because they'd put us out to do all this, that we heard, in fact, on the wireless, through our wireless information, that in fact the war was over. But we also heard that the Japanese...
The European War or the Pacific War?
The Pacific War. Well, the European War didn't really worry us, in a sense. It was the one that we're involved with. And the terrible thing was that the Japs in that area, and it's a historical fact, it's been recorded, decided to fight on. And didn't, in fact, capitulate when the rest of the Japanese people capitulated after the bombs at wherever it was, Hiroshima and so on. They capitulated, but they decided to fight on. But it was, they did capitulate several days later. But in that intervening period, our officers told us to be prepared to make a break for it, because they'd had information from somewhere, so they said, that the Japs were going to murder all the prisoners and that it would be every man for himself.
Did you believe that?
Well, I think we did at the time, yes. Yes. Yes, we did. And that it was every man for himself. But before anything happened, they still kept us going out to work, and the war was over, you see. Totally over. But then they did capitulate, which was fortunate. And I remember leaflets being dropped, and I've still got a sample of leaflet somewhere. And I can remember very well Mountbatten coming in. Lew Mountbatten visited the camp. Poof. Machine gun and white drill. Came and said, well, you won't belong, etc., etc. And the Red Cross came in and weighed us and asked us various questions and so on.
Why was Mountbatten so impressive?
I don't know why. I can remember him in white drill. And he was a good speaker. I can't remember his exact words, but I can remember everybody feeling cheered up after it. And whether he was just on a morale-building effort, I wouldn't know, but we all thought he was great. I remember at the time we talked about it. And, of course, some food came and various items of clothing and so on. Oh, and an interesting experience. Now, the chappie at the garage knew I was in the Cranji camp, right? And it hadn't been so long before that that I'd been taking the tyres with this fellow, and he was telling me the information. There was a message one day from our guardhouse, because we weren't allowed to wander about, because there was a bit of a trouble with the Chinese polishing off a few other Malays that had been traitors and so on. And there was a message came that somebody wanted to see me, and I went, and there was this fellow from the garage who spoke good English, and he said he wanted to take me downtown into Singapore. So I said, well, I shall have to ask. I asked, and I got permission. The main trouble was over. And he took me down in his charcoal-burning car. I remember the total little trailer behind and the burnt firewood in it and so on. And he took me to a genuine Chinese, I can see it now, restaurant with a great big round table with hundreds of little bowls of rice and joss sticks burning and everything. And he gave me a day out. Unbelievable. But he must have made a fortune, I suppose, on the black market. So he was perhaps thanking his agent, I don't know. But I haven't forgotten that incident. It was terrific. Terrific. A little joss sticks, and there was a smell in the atmosphere. It was fantastic. Fantastic.
What physical and mental condition were you in on really?
I was down to 7.5 stone, which I'm now about 14. 7.5 stone. Mentally, I still think... maybe I shouldn't say, still think fairly good. But I was full of beriberi, and I wouldn't have lasted a lot longer, because I'd got in my body, and once it touched your heart, you're a goner. A lot of people died, would just drop dead, because the beriberi, the water got to the heart, whatever it was, and I was quite swollen. But that was in time. I'd had malaria. I was weak, physically. Quite weak, but able to walk, and in fact, probably one of those in better health, because, and that's a comparative word, because we, as such, were asked to help with evacuating the very sick prisoners, which we did, of course. So, and as a result, being fairly well, comparatively well, and getting better all the time once you got decent food and vitamins, we were about the last to leave, I should think, of the prison. We came back on a boat called the New Holland, N-I-E-U-W, a Dutch boat, I remember. And we were, of course, eventually discharged in Liverpool and came straight home. That was... that would be, oh, I don't know the date. We were allowed downtown if we wanted to see the Japanese hand over their swords to Mountbatten on the Padang. That was a very interesting experience.
Can you describe it?
I've been back to see the Padang since, and it looks very, very similar. There were thousands of people there, that's all I can say. And everybody cheered and all the rest of it. And they were a small party in the distance, obviously. You weren't allowed very close. But I think perhaps the thing that cheered the POW as much as anything was to see that the Japs were being forced to work. And they had them on their hands and knees, some of them, for badness, picking grass out of stone, thing like that. And that did the prisoners of war a power of good, actually. Every bit as much as Mountbatten receiving the swords from the Japanese generals. My note's finished, and it says, now, no rice pudding or Japanese cars.
I was going to ask you what attitude your period of imprisonment left you with as regarding the Japanese.
Well, I don't personally hate them now. I mean, it's all over, isn't it? And the children of the Japs, the present ones. But I still have an inborn feeling, and I'm sure that most people must have an inborn of not liking them. I can give you one incident. I used to go on business a lot to London, and I was staying at the Great Northern Hotel at King's Cross. And when I came down for breakfast, the head waiter, as he was then, said, I'm sorry, sir, there's only one seat left, and it's with those gentlemen over there, and there's a party of Japanese, about five or six, maybe more, around a round table, and one seat left. He said, would you care to take that? I said, of course. And they were jabbling away in Japanese. And this would be about 15 years ago, very well. And I thought, yes, right, you devils. So I went over and I gave them a little pucker Japanese bow, and I said, oh, hi-oh, which is good morning in Japanese. They stopped in their tracks. They never said a word, and I just carried on quite calm with my breakfast. Never attempted to talk to them because I couldn't really hold a conversation as such, you understand. And when I went out again, they said, "Wait a minute, God," he said, "I've been trying to do that for days. Whatever did you do?" I said, "Never you, man." Unbelievable. They thought that I knew, understood Japanese, so they stopped talking. Because I've no doubt they were saying things in Japanese that they wouldn't really want you to hear, perhaps. That was quite interesting.
But you wouldn't buy their goods?
I try not to. But unavoidably, you've got to, don't you, sometimes. Yes, but with our, and I was a Ann Leiter company, we never bought Japanese cars. And certainly I don't like rice pudding, even now. I have an aversion to it.
Do you think that your period of imprisonment changed your attitudes in many other ways? That your attitudes towards life or your philosophy of life?
I think it has done. And I'm told that if necessary, I mean, at business I can remember, if necessary I could be absolutely ruthless. And I think I was a bit soft-hearted before, but I'm quite independent. If I want to say something now, I'll say it. Because nothing really now compares or matters compared to something like that. Something what you've been through. This is when I came out, I remember thinking, well, if I've been through that, I can manage anything. And I think that was perhaps one of the manners. You became self-reliant also, and rather a loner. Very much a loner.
So you feel that you've, in an odd sense, derived some advantages?
Well, I think it must have strengthened your character somehow. It's not up to me to really say, but I think it must have done. It must have done. It put everything else into proportion.
Was anything special done for you as a returning Far East POW to Britain?
We were demobbed straight away, I remember, and our pay was brought up to date very quickly. All the governmental side, if you like, was absolutely efficient, no doubt about that. We went through, we were quickly discharged, quickly got our money, there were no delays, nothing. A little printed letter from the King and Queen, all that bull. And also, I got a note that I could go to the local Red Cross to get special supplementary food, which I did do. It was, I forget what it was now, things like Ovaltine, all the special things perhaps you should eat. And I had to eat small meals. Oh, medical examiner, I was passed as reasonably fit, didn't get a pension or anything. The only thing that people like myself and others that I know of have to complain about is I think they gave us about £60 or something, I forget the figure, from Japanese assets. And they've been fighting ever since to get more money out of them, but I believe the Americans and the Canadian, all those people got thousands of pounds. But I mean, too late to bother now, isn't it, really?
Whilst you were a prisoner of war, did you ever believe that you would be released, or did you ever give up hope?
Yes, no, I never, honestly and truthfully, I personally never gave up hope. My only worry was if I became ill of something that I couldn't get over. Because I used to think to myself, well, I used to worry about the people at home, because I used to think, well, I know I'm all right, but they don't know how I am. Which I suppose must be the feeling of every soldier away. Must be. I can't think how anybody can think any different. And in fact, I think my people only got two little cards, which I've got actually, souvenirs. Two little cards, on both of which says I'm fit and well. But I mean, what else could you write?
Did the Japanese ever tell you what your prospects were as a POW?
Never to my knowledge, except that they were going to make you work. They didn't think people should be prisoners, because their Bushido, code of Bushido, I remember, was that you should fight to the end. Well, obviously, the people in command decided it wasn't worthwhile 30,000 people losing their lives for the sake of something that had already happened. So, but they looked down on us almost as vermin.
Did they ever say to you about how long you were likely to be POWs?
No, I don't think. I can't ever remember that coming up. No?
So they didn't ever say to you that you'd be POWs forever?
No, I can't remember that ever. No.
Did they ever speak to you about what would happen as far as ultimate victory for either side was concerned?
No, I don't think the average Jap guard that you spoke to was sort of, I think he was like us, he was interested in his particular local occurrences. And apart from giving you a bit of his propaganda about London, Australia, I don't really think never get that much stuff. I never really think that they said anything about what was going to happen to us, except we had to work for our living. Perhaps they assumed that we were going to work our lives for a living. I don't really know. It was never pointed out as such. Not to me, anyhow.
Did you ever think the Japanese might win?
Never. Never did. Those that did just laid down and died, a lot of them, I think. No. That I'm sure, is a thing that came out of it. I think survivors of that lot are people now with willpower. I'm sure of it.
Did you actually see people...
People gave up, became ill, and they wouldn't fight. Yes, they wouldn't fight. Terrible, really. And it was only caused through, really, just lack of food and medicine and conditions and the climate. The rail was a different matter. That was physical cruelty.
But did you ever get Red Cross parcels?
About the last 3 months, when it was seen, I presume, which way the war was going, then they started to allow parcels in. But many of them had been rifled. And they used to eat the food in front of us. And say, very good, very good, or whatever. Gioto, gioto, that's the word, gioto.
To taunt you?
Pardon? Yes, I think it was taunting more than anything.
Did POWs in Japanese captivity, from your own personal experience, ever conduct what you might call rackets?
Yes. Yes. A certain amount of, even in the early days, there were certain stocks of things like, they may have come from Red Cross, I don't know. I can remember one in particular was Marmite. It sticks in my mind. Marmite. Now, certain people, if you paid them enough dollars or whatever it was, you could get a jar of Marmite. Now, that Marmite was supposed to be kept for the hospital only, for those suffering from acute beriberi and so on, vitaminosis, I mean, a quick dose of Marmite, and it would provide all the vitamins you need, and the water would pour out of you and you'd recover. That is really the only sort of racket, except also I can remember people working rackets against the Japanese, of course. In the workshops, I can remember engineers that worked in the workshops, they used to make razors out of spring steel and stamp them with all the famous names and sell them to the Japanese. They had a marvellous workshop set near Changi for the transport, and all the skilled fitters and that used to work there, and engineers, and they used to mark them with all these famous names and sell them as cutthroat razors to the Japanese. Also, I can remember medical orders telling me, I don't disbelieve it, that Jap guards, a lot of them had VD, suffering VD, and they would go to the medical orderlies and they would say, VD, they wanted something for it. Apparently they couldn't get any themselves, and they would sell them aspirins and things like this, just ordinary little things, and tell them that would cure them and then take them for a ride, in other words. Absolutely.
Did any of the POWs become wealthy through rackets?
I don't really know of anybody that became wealthy. I'm sure quite a few made some money out of it, but the money was no good anyhow, because it was Japanese money. It would only be internal. When the war was over, it was useless. They did cash a certain amount of money for you, but not very much.
Did you come across American POWs?
Two or three. I remember they were naval personnel, and one I can remember played the trombone, and somehow they've got a collection of instruments together, and he was very good, because they used to give camp concerts like you read about in the German camps and everywhere else, and they did give camp concerts occasionally, and they were quite excellent, and the Japs used to thoroughly enjoy them. Yes. And I remember the famous saying, like there was a saying on television of Over the Garden Wall, the saying at one of the concerts I can remember was, you'll never get off the island. You'll never get off the island. I can't remember a lot about them, but I remember that quite a decent band.
I think you wanted to say something about the conditions of the Indian and Gurkha troops who were captured by the Japanese.
Yes. There were two types of mercenaries, if you like to call it that. There were the Indian army, which were Sikhs and Punjabis, and there were the Gurkhas. Now, the Gurkhas, to a man, were 100% loyal to the British. They put them in separate camps. They actually cut the hand off one of the COs, we were told, by the Gurkhas, because he wouldn't sign this and do that. They worked them really hard, and they suffered very, very badly. Now, quite a few of the Indian troops went over into the Japanese National Indian Army, or whatever they called it, I can't remember the name now, but they were sort of very subservient to them, and they were not very nice to us. Sikhs and Punjabis went over. Some didn't, and of course, and they were treated badly again, like the, well, a lot didn't, but they were treated badly again, like the Gurkhas, and they were put in separate camps. But the terrible part was, sometimes they'd put these Sikhs on guard over our camp. I remember at River Valley Road, they put Sikhs on guard, and they we looked at them with loathing. But I mean, it made no difference, did it?
In what way did they treat you badly?
Well, they didn't treat us badly. They just looked at us the same way with loathing. No, they couldn't treat us at all. They were not allowed to touch us. They were simply put there, I think, probably as an insult. I mean, to have you in ex-Indian Army troops guarding you was terrible, isn't it? I thought. But they were known to have a very bad time, the Gurkhas in particular.